We're going to take a look today at Matthew 27. We only have three messages left in Matthew. We've been in Matthew for almost 2 years. And it has been an amazing journey. It's a long time in one book, but I think that it's so foundational to who we are, and that our faith is anchored and rooted in a historical event, and that Jesus is that event. And as we move into the Passion, as we look at his crucifixion today, I want us to be struck by the awe and the wonder of it. I want us to be much less concerned with trying to comprehend all that it means, and I'm pushing for a deeper apprehension of what it means. I think that the crucifixion and the content of the cross and all that was entailed in the suffering of Jesus is not meant to be fully understood. It cannot be fully understood. It is as shrouded in mystery as it was dark over the land for 6 hours. Who could know for sure or even ever declare what exactly was going on with Jesus in those hours of darkness and silence? I am reading a book right now by one of the Inklings. You guys know who the Inklings are, right? That C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and Dorothy Sayers. They're just a group of English intellectuals who love to get together. At a pub at the last service, I said, I think it was called The Bird and the Baby, and then someone's like, The Eagle and Child. I'm like, same thing, same thing. you know, I have reasonable retention. It's just not always exact, you know? I'm more of an interpretive recollector. The Inklings are fascinating. I've read all of the Inklings with the exception of Barfield, and so I'm reading this book by him right now called Poetic Diction. I'm sure you're going to run out and search that one out just by the title alone. But Barfield is fascinating in that he was a philologist. He studied words. Language and its meaning and its history, its origin. And in fact, Lewis, in writing the sci-fi trilogy, based Ransom off of Barfield and said that Barfield was his greatest and least known teacher. But in Poetic Diction, Barfield discusses the transcendent quality of the best writings, specifically in poetry. And it gave me an insight into what I experience when I read about the death of Jesus, the mystery involved in it. And what Barfield says is that that when certain words come together in a particular way that create what he calls aesthetic consciousness, he says the best poetry does this, is that it's the putting together of certain words, and it stirs within us this sense, this feeling that transcends our ability to actually explain it. And the moment we try to grasp at it, it becomes elusive. And I think Lewis drew from this, from Barfield's own studies in this world of aesthetic consciousness and the weight of glory, when he talks about that our longings, when we hear a piece of music that blows our mind, or we read a book that affects us, he said they become like echoes of a land we've yet to visit, or the smell of a flower that we didn't even know existed. It creates an internal sense and longing for something beyond what can be fully comprehended in this experience. And I think we've all had those moments where you ever read something where you feel so deeply, you feel it more deeply than you actually understand it? Maybe I'm too much of a romantic, but I actually dislike literature that, I don't like Hemingway because I don't like how direct he is. I like books to like leave me where I'm like, I kind of get what they're saying, but I like what I feel. That would describe my whole reading experience. Why I like poetry. I'm not going to claim to know what the poet's getting at. I like what it stirs in my heart when it hits on the proper cylinders. So I think that the cross, nothing creates that sort of sense in me like reading and studying. And I spent most of my Christian life trying to get my head around the centrality of the cross. And I still find myself silenced by it. And it puts me in a place of worship. And I think that that's what we should do. I think we should enter into this ground as a sacred ground that is not meant to be fully comprehended. It's meant to be apprehended. It's meant to produce within us an aesthetic consciousness, a sense that we really are the receivers of the greatest and most mysterious gift ever given to creation. And that gift is not something but someone, it's Jesus. And the work of the cross is a mystery that should never be attempted to, we should never attempt to try to explain it. That's why I dislike films about the crucifixion. I didn't like The Last Temptation of Christ, not for the reasons that Christians disliked it. I didn't like The Passion of the Christ. I didn't like the 70s Pasolini famous film about Jesus. For sure did not like anything that's come out in the last few years. But the primary reason I dislike all of them, no matter what the quality, is that they cannot put into picture or into words what makes the cross significant. It absolutely eludes the human intellect. We're called to believe it. We're called to cast our faith, not blindly, but to believe that Jesus really actually did work something out that we cannot get our hands around, and that is our own human brokenness and isolation from the living God because of our sin. And I want us today to realize this, that as we look at this story, what we're going to be looking at and kind of focusing in on is what I call the loneliness of Christ, the absolute loneliness of Christ, the fullness of loneliness. P.T. Forsyth, one of my favorite theologians, who wrote the greatest book, in my opinion, on the centrality of the cross, over John Stott's great book, although that's, I mean, an amazing book, and you do well to read it. But P.T. Forsyth's book, The Cruciality of the Cross, I think is essential reading for anyone that wants to get their head around the power of the gospel. But he says, Christianity is concerned with God's holiness before all else. Now, evangelicals have often stated that, but Forsyth qualifies what he means by it, because often evangelicals throughout church history have defined God's holiness as his otherness, his separateness from humanity. His holiness is his holy otherness, and creates this sort of detached and distant God who is, as the early church fathers defined him, unfortunately, incorrectly, as impassible. The God is unmoved. He's the unmoved mover, which they borrowed actually from Greek philosophers, from Aristotle. And it isn't accurate. God is completely moved, and holiness is not, I would argue, defined by his otherness, but I would agree with Forsyth and with Athanasius, with Barth, that God's holiness is wrapped up in his incarnation. It issues to man as love. He says, holiness comes to us as love. It acts upon sin as grace. It exercises grace through judgment. Have you ever thought of grace being exercised through judgment? But what does Forsyth mean by that? Do we receive grace through judgment? We do, but not through the judgment of us. We receive grace through the judgment of the rightful judge. That Jesus is the judge and the judged in our place. The mystery of the cross is God's willingness to endure and absorb his own wrath, his own judgment. And when we think about the son experiencing wrath, we have to eradicate the angry dad, you know, beaten down son view. When I speak of wrath, I am speaking of the giving over. When God says he gave them over to a debased mind, he who knew no sin became sin, that Jesus was given over to the judgment that we deserved, and that the whole Godhead suffered. They may have suffered differently, but they all suffered. And they suffered for the purpose of our redemption. And here's where we can't get our head around that. Our faith is dependent upon our belief in it, but we can never comprehend it. The aesthetic consciousness is needed here more than anywhere else. Is that the idea of God's holiness is inseparable from the idea of judgment as the mode by which grace goes into action. What Forsyth is saying is that grace comes to us through Jesus, the judge, being judged in our place. So holiness becomes the release of grace, and holiness is revealed through the Son becoming sin. It's not his separateness from sin, it's his willingness, he who knew no sin, to become sin. And that, my friends, is a profound mystery that we should just maybe stop and sing a song right now. You guys wait for me to do that. I'm like, I just don't know what to say, so I'm going to sing. Is that okay? I think that the power of this passage is that we see the fullness of Joseph's own words to his brothers in Genesis 50. What you intended for evil, God intended for good. That here, behold, the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. That Jesus, the God-man, enduring and absorbing into himself, identifying himself with us, making himself our sympathetic high priest by tasting the absolute, ultimate isolation. The isolation of hell itself, a place where relationship is not possible. I believe this is the key to the mystery of the 6 hours of silence. I may be speculative, but I do think that there is plenty of language around Jesus' work on the cross that would state that he most definitely, he could not conquer sin and death unless he absorbed sin and tasted death. So, when we read this, I want us to think about these things. Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. He loved me and gave himself for me. I have been crucified with Christ. One of the reasons I believe that the gospel becomes so confusing for its adherents in our modern age is that we have rewritten the gospel to mean, if I put my faith in Jesus, he will help me or protect me from suffering. And I want you to know that the essence of the gospel, God, just as God's holiness is contradictory to the way that we think about holiness. It's not his separation from humanity, but his full willingness to enter into humanity, exercising grace through judgment. Judgment not of us, but judgment of himself in our place. So it is that our belief in the gospel is not to free us from the tyranny of suffering, but to free us from the tyranny of the need to escape suffering. That's the power of the gospel. To smash the false hopes that we somehow, because we have Jesus, can live a pain-free existence. Because I would argue that the place where you will tend to meet Jesus the most powerfully in this life is actually in the furnace. And so we need to have a right understanding. Because I've gone to enough churches to see the gospel preached in such a way that it's like, if you give your life to great gospel presentation, but it's ended with the most disturbing statement. God's here. He has a perfect plan for your life. And perfect plan in our mind means I'm going to get whatever I wanted. And God then is reduced into some weird cosmic Santa Claus here to give goodies to his kids. Instead of saying God has a perfect plan, but we need to recognize that for us personally, it might be quite difficult. And that the gift of the gospel is not this or that thing that we might want from him, but the gift that he gives is his presence in our lives, whether in suffering or in rejoicing. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And we can say, well, that's unfair. I don't want Jesus in suffering. I want Jesus to relieve my suffering. And all we have to do is look at the suffering that he endured and know that at the least, he understands it. and that we are promised in Scripture that this life is not all that there is. Maybe the problem is that we've put too much stock into what this life can offer us. And in doing so, we lost sight of eternity, which is a really, really long time in comparison. Verse 27, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Twisting together a crown of thorns, they put on his head and put a reed in his right hand, and kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. The loneliness of Jesus is coming into full view here in ways that he himself hinted at. In the upper room, he said, "Tonight, I tell you, each one of you will leave me. You will leave me, but I will not be alone, for my Father is with me." And he knew that the loneliness. He already experienced loneliness throughout most of his existence due to the quality of his character. He was so unlike anyone else that in itself was an isolating factor. The loneliness of Jesus is a fascinating study, but here we see it in the brutality that comes through what our society, you know, every age has its own series of like hot topic words, and bullying seems to be a real popular one today, which I don't know why. I understand that we need to stop, you know, we need to do all that we can to prevent bullying. I just think it's just weird how it becomes so hyped that the value or the meaning of the word becomes, because bullying, I'm pretty sure, has been around since, you know, the first two sons of the, I mean, wasn't Cain a big bully? And we act like it's a new phenomenon. That's what bugs me about it. Because I don't know about you, I don't like to use the word bullied. I would just like to say that I was tormented as a kid. Tormented. You know what it's like to be the boy in a rural farm town of Eastern Washington, sixth grade to ninth grade, the worst years of any boy's life? Puberty, and all you want to do is dance and sing. When you live like in a town that's even more rural and backwards than Friday Night Lights, any Friday Night Lights episode. And the brutality, I remember ninth grade, I can name the three guys that picked on me every single day, called me names that I would be horrified if my kids were called. I remember being punched in my stomach and my books being knocked out of my hand and being teased. And here's the thing, the loneliness that creates is so deep and so profound that it can create in you this willingness to endure even greater mockery and abuse just for the sake of having people close to you. And I would allow myself to be the end of the joke for these kids just so that I could be with other kids. And I think of the brutality that I endured in that, and all I know is that when you suffer at the hands of others, that it creates a real sense of loneliness, and that can create a real bitter spirit. And I hear about people talking about, you know, their distrust of people because of how they were mistreated when they were younger. And I always try to remind people in the church is that, A, I'm not a guy that likes to sit around and I purely tell you this story for the sake of the sermon illustration, not to garner any sympathy from you, because I wouldn't exchange my upbringing for anything. And I know what it was like to have a stepdad who was confused by my love of music. He just wanted me to be an athlete. He was bummed. I mean, I just was an enigma to him. He forced me to wrestle. And I won almost all my matches just out of sheer terror and the desire to remove the singlet. I know what those things are like. I don't think I could have appreciated it until I found my sympathetic high priest. It's easy to enter into life as a victim and you realize that just when you think your life was really hard and you meet someone whose life was way harder. It's funny when we compare pain, isn't it? Just as we compare our victories with one another, we're always measuring ourselves up against others. If you hurt, you'll find someone that wants to tell you how they hurt more. If you succeeded, you'll always find someone that will tell you how they succeeded more. I found that the gospel eradicated the need to live in that past, but gave me the ability to move forward with the calm confidence that whatever I endured, Jesus understood it and proved through his own death that he could transform it into something powerful and beautiful. His loneliness, the fact that Jesus here is being worshiped, and they don't even realize that their mock worship is actually a picture of true worship, that they are mocking Jesus because they do not understand him. They think that it's foolish for a king, if he is indeed a king, and he's no king in their mind because his full identification with the people that they felt didn't even deserve to live. He's the king of the prostitute. He's the king of the lepers. He's the king of the Jews, and we hate the Jews. He's the king of the unwanted, the uneducated. And in their mock worship of him, they were actually closer to the truth than they even could begin to realize. And in his unwillingness to say a word, and one thing that you'll see in Jesus is that he understands our pain, he understands our suffering, he understands our loneliness, because he alone, over anyone who has ever existed, actually had the bandwidth to see that pain through to its ultimate end. He drank the cup and emptied it of its dregs. You never see Jesus collapse in fear. Silence is the word that, for the most part, marks the narratives of the passion. He speaks nothing against the very ones who are beating him and kneeling before him, because their beating him and kneeling before him will be the very means by which he would bring about a possibility of salvation for them. Only Jesus can take the worst that mankind can do. And he, as the judge, is taking the judgment that those men deserved into himself as they were bringing that affliction upon him. And because of that, I can look at my own afflictions in the light of Christ, and I thank God, and I say, Lord, all I can say is that those cruelties that I experienced as a kid, yes, they're formative, yes, they shape our adult life, but only you can bring transformation good out of that. And I trust you with that because you know. You understand. But the mockery and the beatings and the brutality and the false worship leads to the very point of the life of Christ altogether. And in verse 32, it says that they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled this man to carry his cross. There in that one statement, the entire gospel is found. For Jesus is the one who comes to compel us, and he doesn't compel us to follow him that we might be free from a cross, but he bids us to come and die. And Simon carries this cross. This speaks. You notice that Jesus, in the gospel accounts, there is no depiction. Just as there's no description of what he looked like anywhere in the gospels, it's almost disturbing the fragmented way that the accounts of his crucifixion went. These statements are just, and then they scourged him, and then it just moves on. And we read that, and we don't stop and think of like what that means. This is where we need that sense of aesthetic consciousness. We need a sanctified imagination. We need to understand that he's already almost dead by this point. He's probably practically bled to death by this point. He can't even carry his own beam. Can you imagine having your back flayed and then being put against a log where your back was just flayed? But no description is given of the horrors of what he looked like No depths is why I didn't like the Gibson portrayal, because that's not what we're supposed to be focusing on, because there's a mystery behind this. Human suffering, people died horrible deaths. Peter was crucified upside down. People were crucified all the time in the day of Jesus. It's who was crucified and what he was accomplishing in the realm that cannot be understood or comprehended by the human mind. It was the unseen world that was being impacted by this very real moment in human history. But it says, and when they came to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, but when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And this is interesting. You know, Jesus had said to his disciples on the night of his betrayal, he says, I will not drink of the vine again with you until you come into my Father's kingdom. Speaking of his second coming, and there we will have the feast of the Lamb. But here there is almost a Nazarene vow. But I believe that the vow is even deeper. It's more than just a promise to not drink again until he can party with his children. But it's his unwillingness to partake of any kind of freedom from the pain. This gall, most believe, was a type of narcotic that allowed the pain to be at least a little more able to endure it. Wine, even alcohol, is used to relieve pain. And Jesus confronted his agony with his eyes wide open. You see, we can't even get our heads around that, because the moment we feel any pain, we have figured out a million ways to avoid it. Whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, existential pain, we live in the age, we're called to be ambassadors of truth in a world of illusion, and yet often we are people who so participate in the illusions themselves, we don't even know what it means to be ambassadors of truth. We're so quick to avoid pain, but as one of the Inklings brilliantly wrote, Charles Williams in The War in Heaven, of his character who ends up in purgatory, it says, she was not prepared for, because she had not tasted death in this life, she was not prepared for life after death. We can't experience the crown until we've tasted the cross. Jesus not only takes our place and fully faces the judgment that we deserved on our behalf, he also gives us the illustration and the path that we ourselves are to take. He would not drink it. And then here, once again, look how brief this is. And when they crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. The Renaissance paintings of Jesus almost always portray Jesus, this kind of cleansed character on the cross. Like, he's still beautiful. His wounds seem minimal. The crown of thorns seems so small. There's only a few depictions of Jesus in paintings that I think maybe even hint kind of at what kind of brutality he experienced. But when we think about this, and then they crucified him, they didn't just crucify him. One of the most shameful things is that they stripped him naked. The Son of God, naked. Exposed to the world, the humiliation of that, the torment of being this naked man who's been beaten beyond even human recognition. And I just keep going back to that. It's not that he suffered, it's who is suffering. When I think God took that, he took that. Most of us would want vengeance if our kingdom rebelled against us in that kind of ugliness. But God actually uses the ugliness to reveal his commitment to love in spite of the worst that humanity could do. Humanity wants God dead, and it continues to want God dead, and yet he loves us still. Here is the mystery. Love is greater. love is greater than death, and light is most definitely greater than darkness. And it says, and over his head, they put charge against him, which read, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. And then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, and said, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. And there is that temptation again, the temptation for self-preservation, which is the essence of all sin. It's putting self and self-needs and self-wants above the wants of everyone else. It's the preservation of one's own life, the cowardice that can come from that sort of self-centered living, the desire to protect, to live, to put others aside that we might preserve our own fate. This is the essence of sin, and yet this is what our society tells us should be the focal point of our own lives, that you are the only thing that's actually real, and that your dreams and your hopes and your ambitions, you can do anything you want, and you should do whatever it takes to get where you want. And the people that we admire the most, it seems like, in our culture today, we romanticize the rock star and all his narcissistic pomp. We, as a nation, as we move into an election, and often the elections themselves are driven by such incredible self-promotion, we buy into it, hook, line, and sinker. I was saying to Darcy, I'm like, what kind of person actually grows up and says, I want to be the president of the United States of America? That takes a special kind of temperament. And then I also realized that we're a lot more level-headed in the Northwest. I don't think we've ever produced a president in its history. What does that say about us? Has anyone west of the Mississippi ever produced a president? Was Reagan actually from California? He wasn't, was he? See? Midwest and East Coast. Okay, I'm not that much of a historian. It's kind of, it's ruined my illustration. Thanks a lot. Way to bless your pastor. See, I'm still getting bullied today. It's like last week, you guys tormented me over my overalls. It's just, I'm starting to not trust you, really. But I look at this self-promotion that's so prevalent from our politicians to our entertainers to our own wicked hearts. And Jesus here is tempted, just like the temptation of the devil. Save yourself. But Jesus said, there's no greater love than this than to lay down your life for your friends. And the scripture even goes further, that he didn't just lay down his life for his friends, he laid down his life for his enemies. For he prayed himself, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. One of the few times he actually talks, he makes 7 brief statements from the cross, giving an interpretation of his own crucifixion. It's like Jesus is giving a sermon, an exposition of what he's actually doing through the things that he says. But I believe that this is fascinating because everyone around him, the few people that are there for him, it says they stood in the distance, utterly alone, his isolation being more and more complete. And he was prepared for this isolation. He was prepared for this loneliness. He was prepared for this mockery. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the shame, we're told. Galatians 3:13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. He was cursed by people. He was a curse based upon Jewish tradition. Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. He's cursed and mocked by his own. The priests mocked him. He saved others. He cannot save himself. They don't realize that in order to save others, he could not save himself. He needed to experience the full loneliness and isolation that comes through complete and total judgment, and he was willing to take it all the way. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God, and the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Chrysostom, one of the patristic fathers, has a fascinating commentary on Jesus' crucifixion in the public eye, the naked Christ brutalized in the open for the world to see. He says that Jesus was not crucified indoors, but in the open air to teach the salvation of the whole world, that the nature of the air might be purified, that the earth also being cleansed by the blood that dropped from his side. Indeed, even the cross's geographical location occurs at the center of the earth, that it might be equally free to all nations. For on this tree of life, the salvation and life of all persons is suspended. The very shape of the cross also signifies the church spread through the four quarters of the earth, Anselm says. And all that Adam lost at the beginning of his history is more than found here at the center of history, Augustine says. Jesus is both the center of time and space. And I think that the profound statement here is that Jesus here in this open space, being mocked on all sides, the isolation moving toward its completion, because at this point we find the supernatural outcome. The light of the world begins to go dim. The God who is light and in him is no darkness at all turns the shining of his face away from his son. I would argue he does not lose his grip. But it says in verse 45, nothing is more isolating than the darkness of hell itself. Nothing. Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders hearing it said, this man is calling for Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Darkness has come over the world. I don't believe it was a local darkness. I think it was an actual darkness that came over the world, like moving back toward the Genesis account, and there was darkness. The world was void. It was chaos. The void is what we're spoken of in the first few verses of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it says, and there was darkness over the waters. The void, the chaos. And the chaos of hell, the depravity of humanity, the blackness of a night that could not be penetrated by the eye or the mind. Jesus, under that darkness, in silence, he said, I only speak that which the Father has given me to speak. And in this 6 hours, there was no sense of the Father whatsoever. And at the end of the ninth hour, Jesus cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And here's what's fascinating, is that people have tried to interpret this mysterious verse in a million different ways to get around the idea that God is an unchanging God. He is not, he's impassible. And so that's not the divinity of Jesus crying out, that's the humanity of Christ crying out. You can't do that without doing damage to what the church has held to from its very beginning, which is that Jesus was both God and man fully. He wasn't God cloaked in human flesh. He became a man as God, and he will continue to be a man for all of eternity, is what we believe. There's never a point. He's not going to shuffle off his humanity. He became a man for us, the scripture declares. And what you need to understand is that this darkness brought forth something that Jesus himself, the all-knowing God, did not know, could not have known. A new experience for God himself. And that experience was not an ontological separation, which means that there wasn't some rift. Jesus wasn't torn apart from his Father. The Godhead wasn't split in half. That's not feasible, for God is spirit. But there was relational separation as Jesus took upon himself the full weight of human brokenness, because sin at its essence is a destruction of relationship. It's a loss of relationship with God, a loss of relationship with others, and a loss of relationship with ourselves. And Jesus fully took that. Hell, in its essence, is a place where relationship is not. It's not a place where God does not exist. It's a place where relationship with God is impossible. Jesus experienced relational separation from the Father. And I have been told, and I believe it with all of my heart, because I have experienced it, the closest experience to hell on earth is to be abandoned by someone you thought loved you. Many of you have tasted heartbreak. I always say you're not truly a human being until you've had your heart broken. I mean, really broken once. It's just good to have it really, really smashed. And I know what that's like, to cry myself to sleep, to get really desperate and do those pathetic things like show up at her window in the middle of the night and beg in tears. That really makes a girl want to come back. They love that. If you're heartbroken, don't be that weird, creepy guy that's just hanging outside the window. Don't do that. It's over. It's game over if you do that. It was for me. But the experience of heartbreak, and I would even go further, not just simply the heartbreak of a broken relationship, of a lost love, but even the heartbreak of losing someone you loved. Darcy was telling me the sensation that she had the morning after her brother had died in her arms, her only brother, who was her best friend, Jason, 24 years old. She held him in her arms and while he was in a coma, and he literally passed away in her arms. And she remembers them taking him away, and she remembers the horrible loneliness and emptiness of waking up that first morning without him there. Jesus tasted that kind of loneliness, but amplified by all of humanity. And he did it for you. And he experienced a separation. Here's the mystery. We can only fall on our knees and worship that he went to hell, whatever that means. Separation of relationship from the living God. Complete isolation. You will all leave me, but my Father will not leave me. And yet, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he wouldn't have spoken that unless he had experienced it and come through it. And this is what I want you to see. He poses a question. We cannot diminish it. I tried to once turn this into a victory cry. I don't think that it is. I think it is a picture of what true faith is. Because he wouldn't have said, my God, why have you forsaken me, if he didn't believe that God was there. He spoke it knowing God was there, but not knowing where to find him. See, some of you, in your suffering, in your loneliness, in your heartbreak, you have begun to doubt that God is there. But I think as long as you are able to say, God, where are you? You're actually proving that you still believe. That even your doubt is evidence of your faith. Because had Jesus truly not believed, he would have said, people, why has my God forsaken me? But he directs it right to the Father he knows is there but cannot perceive him. And I believe that it is believing God even when we do not feel him is what we are taught at the deepest level in this statement. It's the beauty of the gospel that frees us from the necessity of escaping our challenges and gives us the courage and the ability to endure. Because I don't think that the days are going to get easier. I think the days are getting darker. And hostility toward the gospel is growing greater. Depression, anxieties is increasing at an ever a growing rate. And part of that can be tempered by a right understanding of the gospel. Quit coming to Jesus to find escape. And come to Jesus and know that the greatest gift that he can give you is not an escape from your pain, but a willingness to be in it with you. We can never accuse him of not understanding. We can never accuse him of not playing fair. He says, in this life, you will have tribulation. And I would argue once again that our greatest joy is finding him in the midst of it. What separates us from the world that does not believe is not the fact that we suffer less. It's how we deal with our suffering. It's the ability to confront suffering with a calm confidence that says, I know in whom I have believed, and I am confident that he is able to keep that which I have entrusted to him. He is able. And it says, some of the bystanders hearing it, they try to give him a sponge of sour wine. But the other said, wait, let us see whether Elijah comes to save him. And Jesus cried out again, and with a loud voice, he yielded up his spirit. Once again, there is another use of that word, the word that we've been considering the last few weeks. He was handed over. The spirit of Jesus is handed over. He cried out again with a loud voice. Luke says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He gave up his spirit, showing that he was in control. They didn't take his spirit from him. He gave up his spirit. It was in his control to give up his life, and he did it. And I believe that there is a power in this statement, because here we have one of the great realities, that the spirit is given. His death is our liberation. The voice of Jesus is the vehicle of the Holy Spirit. He is in control, and he entered into our lost existence, and he experienced the darkness of complete relational separation from the Father, so that we today could gather and worship a God who has restored our relationship to him through his Son. And the mystery is found in this close. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from the top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split, and the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly this was the Son of God. And here we have the cosmos itself registering the strangeness of this event. All of earth groans, Paul writes, groans in Romans chapter 8 for its reconciliation, for its redemption. Jesus said, if the children did not worship me, the rocks would cry out. And the rocks don't just cry out, they break open. Jesus breaks open the world in this powerful way. And the tearing of the veil in half is a picture. The veil was up, separating man from the holiness of God. Remember I said holiness before was defined by God's separateness from sin. Now holiness receives its full definition of God's entrance into sin and his conquering of it through his Son Jesus. And he conquered it by actually becoming it without succumbing to it. Not only that, the temple is ripped. What are the two great enemies of human existence? Our own sinfulness and death. Death. We are driven by an obsession with death, or at least a desire to avoid it, a desire to somehow escape it. I think it's interesting, even our current fascination with zombies. I'm not totally sure what that means, but it just tells me that once again, we have figured out a multitude of ways to sedate the reality. You know, there's not a lot of films about people, and I don't know any TV series that just focus on a hospice. That's not, you know, that's like not cool. We need something that actually makes us feel like the fact that each one of us are going to die, and that the death rate is one per person, by creating these false ideas. But here we have the supernatural happening in a very real way. And I think it's interesting that the tombs break open and the saints are seen, because here we see even that fulfillment, the life and death of Jesus, that the Son of Man comes to set the captives free. And I think both on a metaphorical plane, but it's not really metaphorical, on a supernatural plane, that we are set free. We were captives to our own sin and we're set free through our faith in Christ. But the idea that those who had put their faith in the future hope of God's promises find its fulfillment in Jesus. And here there's this strange moment where the saints rise from the dead. Now, Jesus is called the firstborn over a new order. And so many theologians have tried to explain this away, saying that can't be because Jesus has to be the first one risen from the dead. But I think that we're foolish when we say things like that, because what we're trying to do is put that which is outside of time itself into a temporal understanding. I believe what the resurrection of the dead at this moment is like. If you guys have ever recorded, for those of you who like have done music, you'll know what reverb is. Reverb is what you hear in this room right now. It's what makes, when you get up to go to the bathroom, why we all partake in that movement. It's you give your toddler a rattle upstairs, we all enjoy it. When I speak, I sound magnificent in this room. But in Southeast, not so much. There's no reverb in that room. So when I speak, Tim and I were just talking about it. It's like we talk and the words just fall out of our mouth at our feet on the floor because the room's so dead. There's this reverb. It's like it takes your voice and amplifies it. But there's also this thing you can do that's cool. I just finished the new Pilgrim record yesterday, and we used this. It's called a pre-delay, a pre-reverb. And it sends a signal from your voice, and the voice that's coming, it has this slight effect where you hear it before it comes. And then it comes, and then it's followed by more reverb, and it becomes encased in this movement. And I believe that the resurrection of the saints here is almost like this reverberation of what's coming through the resurrection of Jesus. That there's this, and if you think that example is esoteric, I don't care, because I thought it was kind of cool. So I think that there's this picture is that you're getting a glimpse into something that goes beyond this world order. Although the work of Jesus is done at a particular point in time, in human history, at a place, the gospel is a very material thing in many ways. That the very work of God's redemption for humanity took place through a human being at a particular point in human history, and that he really lived and he really died and he really rose from the dead, that sanctifies the material, eradicating that distinction between the sacred and the secular. But there's also an unseen reality that goes outside of time. That's why I always think it's dumb when we talk about election as something that happened back there at some point in time. When it says before the foundation of the world, it means in God, which means not like we think about time. So this moment is a picture of the power of his death is already the reverberations of what is coming through his resurrection is already being experienced. The giving up of his spirit. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. I've completed. It is finished. The finishing work of Jesus on the cross and the stamp of approval through his resurrection, which we will consider next week, is found here. And it says, when the centurion and those who were there saw it, they said, surely this is the Son of God. This is the Son of God. Truly, in a world of illusion, they for the first time saw the truth. You guys, we are called to be the ambassadors of truth in a world of illusion. We will never be that if we try to escape the difficulties of living. But if we embrace the life that we've been given with faithfulness and cling to our trust in Jesus, even when we do not feel he is there, our witness will be unstoppable. And the gospel, the more you live according to the truth of the gospel, regardless of what you feel, I promise your feelings will follow. But you cannot allow your feelings to dictate the facts. The facts must take precedence over the feelings. And God is a feeling God, and he created us feeling creatures. He wants us to feel deeply, but he wants our feelings to flow from the firm, solid foundation, the reality, as I like to say, in which all other realities hinge, Jesus himself. He himself is our center. There is no other, for there is no other name under heaven by which one can be saved, because this Jesus, and I just explained to you the mystery without explaining a thing, and I don't think that that's a commentary on my incapability of preaching. I think it's a commentary on the fact that this is not meant to be comprehended. It's meant to be apprehended with worship and awe. Jesus understands, and he loves you, and he gave himself for you. Would you give yourself to him today? Would you be an ambassador of truth in a world of illusion? Take your suffering and entrust it to Christ. Quit trying to seek escape from every dilemma, and instead, give yourself to Jesus and say, whatever this day brings, I will worship you, my King. Let's pray.